A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Thank you very much. Welcome along to the Slacktivist Action Group. The Conservative Manifesto has been launched. And they obviously accuse Labour of going back into the past. And then we have a look at their election manifesto. And in there is a death tax, also bringing back grammar schools and also bringing back fox hunting. Now, we've had this debate before. We had a government inquiry, didn't we, which said fox hunting was an inefficient form of pest control, which probably has not come as too much of a shock to us. When you've got a mouse in your house, you put down a bit of poison, don't you? You don't get dressed up in your Sunday best, get pissed off your tits and chase after it with a pack of cats. Theresa May has said that when it comes to grammar schools, it'll be different this time around because you will not be judged a failure aged 11 because there'll be another chance to get in age 14, another chance to get in age 16. So it seems you can now be judged a failure three times over and quite possibly again aged 18 when you apply to maybe go to university. And if you get turned down from university these days, oh, it hurts that much more, doesn't it? I'm terribly sorry. Your exam results were so shit, we're not even going to let you give us 30 grand. That will hurt, won't it? And 80% of teachers are against grammar schools, and this is winding them up. But as we know, it is actually very easy to wind up a teacher, isn't it? All you've got to do to wind up a teacher is go, "Ooh, you've got long holidays." And then if you follow that up with, "And you finish at 3:30, oh, they're livid, aren't they? "I've got me marking. I've got me marking." I was thinking, wouldn't it have been brilliant if we'd known how easy it was to wind up teachers when we were at school? You know, the teachers there going, "Oh, you're not working very hard. I'm not working very hard. Look at your long holidays. And you finish at 3:30. You're virtually part-time. You are. I've got me marking." And the accusation is that Labour's manifesto is taking us back to the 1970s. But psychologists reckon that actually Britain as a nation was actually happiest in the 1970s, which is somewhat counterintuitive, isn't it? We tend to think of the 1970s as all blackouts, strikes, fights between mods and rockers on bank holiday Mondays. But at least they were getting outside in the fresh air and getting some exercise. And of course, we could still enjoy "I'm a leader" without any negative connotation. But now we have this election coming up when Theresa May has decided to stand on strong and stable leadership. Now, the previous Conservative slogan, that was long-term economic plan, wasn't it? It didn't work out terribly well, that, did it? I don't remember the 2015 Conservative manifesto saying our long-term economic plan is to have an economic plan for a year and then we'll hold a referendum that we think we're going to win but we won't. We'll say we'll definitely stay in the single market but we won't. We'll say we will actually cut immigration to tens of thousands but we won't. The Prime Minister will then resign. The Chancellor of the Exchequer will then get sacked. The Justice Secretary will then stab the future Foreign Secretary in the back, and the Home Secretary, who nobody rates, will then become the unelected Prime Minister, who will repeatedly say we won't have an early election, but will then hold an early election under the banner of strong and stable leadership, although she was the third most powerful member of the previous government, which was so obviously weak, unstable, and copiously full of shit. Go figure. Go figure. And she is going to win in a landslide, ladies and gentlemen. That's what they say. The world, it seems, has gone mad. We will now find out, or hopefully some people who will throw some light on this. Would you please welcome our three guests tonight? Danny Finkelstein, Jane Martinson and Ed Byrne. Thank you for coming along. We try and bond early doors with the group by we make a confession where we're feeling there's something in an ideal world that we would actually like to be less slack about. So, Ed, maybe if you could start us off with something in an ideal world you would be less slack about.
I think the thing I am at the moment too slack about is the spoiling of my own children. I do spoil them, and I shouldn't, and I'm turning them into people I hate, which... It's not a nice thing to do to your own children, to make yourself hate them.
Does that mean that then the more you hate them, the less you'll spoil them, therefore the better they'll be, then you can afford to spoil them again?
No, because then I hate them so much I feel guilty for how much I hate them, so I start being even nicer to them than I want to be. And it is. An example of this, of how spoilt my children are, we have a trampoline in our garden that is bigger than my first flat. It's... the biggest trampoline I have ever seen. And I sound like I'm boasting. I'm not. I'm ashamed of how big our trampoline is. And that's a fact. And they'll get on this monstrosity, and they'll bounce for about a minute, and then they'll lie down and go, "Daddy, bounce us." And I hate them. And I want to go, "Well, Daddy didn't even have a trampoline when he was your age. Daddy's trampoline was his bed. And he broke it. And he spent a year sleeping in a satellite dish."
But they're... they are one of the, aren't they, the most dangerous of toys you can give your kids? There are more visits to A&E based on kids' trampolines than anything else, which is why it was quite interesting that John Lewis in their advert was suggesting you buy one and put it up on Christmas Day when it's icy, just to guarantee you spending Boxing Day in hospital.
Yes, they are what the pogo stick was in the 70s, the trampoline is now in the modern day. And is that if you bring a child in with a broken limb, the nurse just looks and goes... trampoline, like that's
big.
But they gotta learn.
So, Jane, what would you like to offer to the group?
Well, mine are all around the issue of sort of IT and health. So, I feel like inside my mind is constantly saying, "You are just too slack about this." So, I'm constantly sort of, you know, my IT. I've never ever managed to get all the pictures that I've taken on the various phones online into albums and folders, and my oldest is now 15, and there are all these like thousands and millions, because obviously I take at least 50 photos of one shot now and think I'll edit it and don't, and then find myself putting it in the iCloud because that's enormous and can never be edited. And I literally lie awake sometimes at night thinking the iCloud is going to die and I will never have any photos. So I feel really a sort of constant sense of
alternatively,
slack stress.
It'll be hacked and your kid's childhood will be compromised for many years. But you're far better organised than I am. I still have phones that I'm not even sure I've still got the leads for, with photos at some stage I'm hoping to get off them.
But don't you have that sort of cupboard at home? I now have a cupboard which really smells of sort of IT dampness. Which has got leads and boxes and just old bits of BlackBerry chargey things. Little black things and silver things. I don't know where they go.
If it smells of dampness, the chances of you getting that to work sounds slim. What about you, Danny? What would you like to offer?
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm slack about is saying no. It's like really ironic because my entire politics basically is about saying no. But in my personal life, I find that completely impossible to say no to anybody. And it was fine, you know, when you're sort of busy and there's not enough, you know, people aren't asking you to do things, then you can say, you don't need to say no. But if you end up sort of getting lots of invitations and you can never say no to any of them, you end up not answering at all, and then you're very impolite. So saying no, I think...
That's a great thing to admit to, in the sense now that anybody listening to this is now going to be going, "Oh, Danny, you'll definitely do it. I heard him."
We've got a charity auction we'd like you to donate some shirts to, please.
And that is basically what happens. So the answer is always yes. There are basically two things. Either you say yes, or you do something worse than that, which is you don't answer. Or you answer, but you can't actually deliver what you said you would do. So actually saying no would be kinder, but I can't remember to do it, basically, at the moment.
You say your politics is about saying no. You obviously write for The Times. which is now behind a paywall. In the past, I've very much always enjoyed the first paragraph of your articles before it's faded out.
That is actually the best bit. Although the greatest thing, people basically, they read the first paragraph, they can't pay for the rest of it, or they say, I won't pay for it because it's owned by Rupert Murdoch, which is the other one. And then basically they give you an opinion based on reading that paragraph and tell you what was in the rest of it. Somebody the other day said that, somebody suggested you should read Danny Finkelstein's column, and the person replied, I won't read it, it's twaddle. It was absolutely brilliant, they hadn't read it, and they weren't going to, but they were sure.
Is there pressure on you, though, to make that first paragraph really enticing, so as people then think, oh, I need to subscribe to this. It's like a whodunit. What is Danny going to say in paragraph two?
Yeah, but you do get immense misunderstandings based on people just reading the first paragraph.
Obviously, we have this election coming up. You yourself stood for the election, I believe, 2001 in Harrow for the Conservatives. You wrote this article recently saying how spoilt ballot papers aren't necessarily spoilt, that they can actually count as a vote, that if the returning officer comes to you, shows you, and if the abuse that you've received happens to be within the box itself, that can count as a vote for you.
I've honestly had a vote where someone wrote tosser, but they wrote it through my box, so that counts as a vote for me. I've actually... It really did. I've run for Parliament twice. Once I was only 24 years old. I ran against Ken Livingstone for the SDP, and I was so young. And I got a letter at home from the Citizens Advice Bureau, and it said, "Dear Mr. Finkelstein, it was so nice to meet you, comma, and your mother."
I've changed my mind. I'm less concerned about my kids. I now feel I should be less slack about spoiling my votes.
But people do. But you do at least, you know, if you do write something rude on a ballot paper, providing you don't put it in their box, the candidate will see it. That is a bit of reassurance.
Lovely. The 2001 election, which you were standing for, you've compared the Conservatives then to Labour now, in the sense that in terms of trying to reorganise the party, it actually wasn't as easy as people think. When it comes to Corbyn, those sort of Corbyn-supporting politicians are more likely to keep their seats. They tend to be in safer seats. Therefore, it could be that Corbyn losing in a landslide could counterintuitively actually increase his power in the party.
Well, you lose the marginal seats, and the marginal seats tend to be in places where, for example, the Conservatives weren't well represented in cities. And when we lost a load of seats in 1997, it was all in suburban areas and cities, and so therefore the people that remained were committed to the sort of policies that can win you support in countryside areas where the Conservative Party already had support, and you lose the moderate voice. And so that is definitely a problem. If Labour did lose that sort of number of seats, and we don't know whether it will, it would mean that the marginal seat voice, which is important in terms of moderating the party, loses disproportionately to the core vote group.
And you were saying that you were involved in the 2001 election, that you go to bed at midnight and get up at five, and you repeat that for many weeks in the lead up to the election. Now, obviously, you can't operate at that sort of level at any given time. Mistakes will be made if you are doing that. Do you think that if everybody'd had a good night's kip, that maybe William Hague wouldn't have said he'd drunk 14 pints a night or worn a baseball cap or what have you?
Yeah, in fact, I was talking to somebody today about the Thatcher election campaigns, and he said he just simply didn't get enough sleep. The worst thing we did in the 1997 election campaign, because Tony Blair wouldn't debate against John Major, we decided that it would be a good idea to send a chicken round the country pursuing Tony Blair to point out that he wasn't debating. And of course, it wasn't a real chicken. It was an out-of-work actor in a chicken suit. But the problem was, the more he saw of Tony Blair, the more impressed he was by him. So eventually, I got a call from central office saying, Danny, we're really, really worried that the chicken's going to defect to the Labour Party. And my job, I promise you, this is absolutely true, my job for the rest of the campaign was to have lunch with the chicken in the staff canteen to prevent him from defecting.
But did it work? Did it work?
We lost in a landslide, but the chicken didn't cross the road.
I'm curious, what do you eat when you take a chicken for lunch? You need to be very careful about ordering the omelette.
I know what we ate, in fact, because it was sausages. And the reason I know that is because the sausages created an incredibly unprofessional but very strong sausage smell. And so in the middle of the Conservatives' largest landslide defeat of 150 years, our main concern was how to employ an extractor fan in order to remove the sausage smell from the middle of central office.
Talking of Tony Blair, though, you're writing recently that you obviously voted Remain, and there's a hope amongst Remainers that some of the Leave voters will... I mean, Tony Blair likes to say that they voted with imperfect knowledge, that they may well
rue it, says the man who obviously still believes that going to war with Iraq was a good idea, although we've yet to find weapons of mass destruction or what have you. But your theory is that actually just in the act of voting leave makes people a stronger leave voter,
course, yeah.
And the chance of leave voters changing their mind, it's a fool's paradise.
Yeah, I was trying to work out why it was that people who voted for Tony Blair in the 1997 election, on the basis that he would match Tory spending, immediately after the election, Tony Blair said, people have voted for me so that I'll increase NHS spending. And in fact, he'd actually explicitly said he wasn't going to do that. And the Conservatives all thought, well, you know, when he says that, everyone will go, oh, you lied to us. In fact, people were delighted. And part of the reason was that the act of voting Labour had made them more willing to accept Labour's agenda, because that's who they now were. They'd actually signed up on a piece of paper. You know, it was this isn't, you know, a reasonable comparison in a way, but one of the ways that Chinese used to get confessions from prisoners was to make them write down their confession. If you actually put a cross in a ballot paper, it's a very concrete thing that you do. So when people vote leave, even if they were quite marginal leave voters, they become more committed to that position by doing that. And so expecting them to change their mind easily is expecting something that human beings don't do. And
so if you've dressed up as a chicken, you're more keen to dress up as a chicken next time.
That sort of
theory. And Jane, for the Guardian, you looked at last week that the fact in the run-up to Brexit, immigration, in terms of the papers, was presented on the whole very negatively. Theresa May has now committed to this tens of thousands figure. But we've got a point system for people outside the EU. Surely if we just increase that for everybody, you know, people seem to be slightly against, let's say, plumbers or whether it's fruit pickers coming into this country, but people seem to be more keen on scientists or centre forwards or tennis players or whatever it may be.
I'm not sure though. I don't think people are that anti-plumbers and fruit pickers, are they? But I think part of the problem with this immigration thing is that people sort of go, if you say, do you actually like these, you know, the increase of plumbers? I think actually quite a lot of people say, yeah, that's been a really good thing. Or the fact that you get the Fruit Growers Association almost immediately on June the 24th going, oh, hang on a minute, we've got quite a lot of people that we really need. I don't think there's any specific group, despite all the stuff that you read. I think it's this sense of, oh, immigration, they're coming in, they're using all our public services. And it doesn't, this whole idea of a point system, and there I think the media has been really influential. I mean, you can talk for the rest of the night about how influential the papers are on a vote, because obviously everyone has lots of different ways of making their minds up. But where you get things like the front page of the Daily Mail with a big picture saying, let us in, we're from Europe, and actually the video, if you click on it online, has these men, women and kids saying, we're from Syria. That's a bit of a confusing picture, isn't it? If you're just going to look at the front page as you go past, even if you're not a Daily Mail reader.
The worry they were saying about the point system was that people can cheat the system. But, I mean, in some ways, that surely shows some ingenuity. And shouldn't that count a few points itself, if you can actually manage...
Yeah, I think probably quite a lot of points. It's like the sort of, you know, there was the outrage over the Dubs children. So there was supposed to be 350 children brought in, and then all the papers, it was all very exciting, you know, eventually, after months and months and months, these kids sort of being kept, possibly longer, in these Calais camps, eventually they were allowed over, and they arrived at in Croydon, and there were all the sort of Fleet Street newspaper journalists and photographers, and there were a few who didn't look like fresh-faced babies bouncing up and down on trampolines, because they had just travelled for many, many weeks in really disgusting, hazardous conditions and looked, some of them, not like six-year-olds.
Ed, you obviously, there was a lot of, after the referendum result, a lot of people scrabbling around desperate to try and get themselves an Irish passport. You're in quite a strong position with that one.
I've already got one of those, I just went to New Zealand and for the first time had that thing of, my passport isn't one of the ones that gets you through the electronic gates in New Zealand. It's just UK, Canada, Australia, USA, and that's it.
No.
Yeah, they pick and choose who gets to go through the electronic gate.
Well, that's shocking.
I was most offended. I didn't even think. And I did this is how long I've been living here. I saw the UK flag. I saw the Union flag. I went, oh, that's all right. That's me. That's where I live. Well, and I went, and my Irish passport, and you wouldn't look at me like
I read a review of something you'd done recently in The Guardian, and you were described as British. So I'm sure the head of Guardian's head of media would like to apologise for that. I'm sure.
Yeah. I think the apology has been made.
They did print an apology in their omissions and errors section, but it was, as Dara pointed out on Twitter, what was interesting is that in the same sentence they had accused us of cultural imperialism whilst at the same time subsuming Ireland back into Britain. Because it was quite a...
We like to save space.
and as an EU national living on the Hertfordshire-Essex border, are you feeling loved, Ed, or are you feeling like a man that we voted to fuck off home?
No. Do you know what? I get quite offended when people don't consider me an immigrant. That's a weird thing. I get that argumentative thing where when people start giving out about the immigrants and stuff, and I go, well, I'm an immigrant. No, you're not an immigrant. You're one of us. That's exactly what they're doing. Again, that's the cultural imperialism thing. Again, the fact is Ireland and Britain have a separate agreement, as you know, that's separate from Schengen and separate from the EU, where we have a free movement anyway. But that's now being, you know, that's now in jeopardy because of you guys leaving the... You guys.
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm on the other side.
These bloody immigrants coming over here telling us that...
When I'm trying to get in New Zealand, I'm British.
George Osborne was in... Danny was in the Evening Standard last week criticising this the policy of the tens of thousands. There was a quote some time ago from The Spectator, what Danny writes today, George thinks tomorrow. Now, if George was writing it last week, it's something you've been thinking for some time, or...?
Well, he's always been immigration liberal, and he's always thought that the tens of thousands target wouldn't work. I actually share his doubts about whether the tens of thousands target will work or is the right number. I think his position on immigration is not realistic politically. So I think that, you know, I understand it. I'm son of two refugees myself. My own instincts, I couldn't really care how many immigrants there are in the country. I think it's fine. But you've got to recognise public opinion on this subject, and I think it's unrealistic, particularly for a Conservative politician, but, you know, for anybody, really, and I think Labour's also finding this, it's unrealistic not to recognise that and try to do something to accommodate and respect that view.
From your point of view, you've been criticised in the past that you were possibly compromising your journalist credentials by being too close to politics. Mm. It must have been fairly interesting for you recently seeing George Osborne criticised about his... political credentials for becoming too close to journalists.
Yeah, my view is that you gain something and you lose something. I've always been very clear about what my politics is and what my political involvement is, and readers who read me know it, and they gain something, which is some insight into a particular type of politics and a particular, you know, sort of insider view, and they'll lose something. You wouldn't look to me to have a completely neutral view, and if you read me, you know that. So, and I think it's interesting, there is a lot of crossover. So I always thought that George would be a very good editor of the Evening Standard, which I think so far he certainly has been, because he had a sort of instinct about how newspapers works, and that he was very interested in that. So there's a lot of overlap between those worlds.
And he's having quite a laugh at the moment, isn't he? He must have enjoyed himself today, calling it a U-turn. You know, Theresa May had said that this the social care thing, she was just clarifying the policy. He said, oh, no, that's a U-turn. He'll be calling it an omni-shambles next, won't he?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because, I can't so much criticise what when people make big mistakes on any side, Labour or the Conservatives, because you just do make them. And anybody who... my mum always used to say, you know, the person who washes the dishes is the person who breaks the cups. So if you make big political decisions, you just will make mistakes. And I think Theresa May's team thought that George made mistakes just because he was careless, and now they've made pretty much a similar mistake, which is...
After only 4 days.
Well, it's not. Obviously, they've been in for a while, but, you put out there things that you then think, my goodness, I hadn't really thought through the public reaction to that, and then you have to row back from it.
Surely the difference is whether or not you say, oh, yes, I did break the cups, but I'm the one that's doing the dishes, rather than saying, I didn't break the cups, I am merely re-examining the cup formation.
I know.
Well, really experimenting with another way of using cups in a fragmented form.
Right. I think, I mean, I do actually, because I think an awful lot of Theresa May's... appeal to those, you know, to people, is because they think she's straightforward. I think she's got to be very careful not, you know, that she doesn't lose that in time, in order to protect not making a U-turn. I think people will respect the fact that you do it. I mean, it's suboptimal, let's put it that way, to come out with a scheme. It's suboptimal to come out with a scheme that you can't defend after a few days. And I preferred the one that she had before to the one that she's got now. But nevertheless, you make mistakes, and I think it's better just to say, well, look, we listened to public reaction and we've moved it, rather than try and say you haven't moved.
I've always thought that the yelling of U-turn is a very counterproductive thing. Like, if somebody has decided to do something that's a bad idea, and they realise it's a bad idea, and they change their mind about it, we ought to respect that. Otherwise, people will continue down the road of bad ideas.
If you're very clumsy, and you've agreed to do the washing up, and then you suddenly say, I don't think I should be doing the washing up.
I was thinking more in terms of, we're heading for that iceberg. You know, well, you better turn then. No, I'm into strong and stable leadership of this boat.
I know, it is.
Because if I swerve to miss this iceberg, everyone will think I'm some sort of pussy weak captain who doesn't, you know, so...
That's generally my view, and I press it usually, but, obviously, if you're running an election campaign, you're saying you're strong and stable, you've got to be careful that you appear there.
But also, that doesn't fit into a headline, whereas U-turn...
No, that's a long headline,
Perfect for a headline.
Yeah.
Particularly for a woman who cannot do anything without being compared, obviously, to our only other female Prime Minister, who was never for turning. So it's going to be used a lot, because if she gets elected, obviously, on June the 8th.
Yeah. Well, you've been having to watch the TV debates for The Guardian.
Having to watch.
Yeah.
So the leader, actually, after last Thursday, that was having to watch, definitely. Yeah.
You know, the five other leaders were on. I believe Tim Farron and Nicola Sturgeon... They've got another one on June the 4th. Paul Nuttall, I don't think, does have another one, but it probably says on his website that he will.
Yeah, there was so much to say about that that performance. I mean, I'm very much hoping that one of you is going to call me Natalie at some point tonight, because I am a woman, and obviously there's only one name that you can keep in your head for me, but it's not, it's Jane. I mean, you know, the amazing thing in a way is that UKIP... You know, Nigel Farage made an enormous, enormous fuss to get onto those leaders' debates in 2015. But now you have a party which has sort of plummeted in the polls. They don't even have one MP. They do have support in the country, but they're sort of, when they're coming up doing this dog whistle, that is exactly what it is. It feels like they're sort of more extreme statements that he's coming up with. He's sort of just trying to shift the debate, as opposed to, say, necessarily elect me.
I mean, the extraordinary thing about Paul Nuttall is, you remember that when there were all these different people who became leader of UKIP, including Nigel Farage himself,
Diane James was 18 days she lasted after Nigel Farage kissed her.
And people kept on going, you know, well, just wait for Paul Nuttall, he's the really good one. It's like, how bad? He is definitely one of the worst politicians I've ever seen. He's quite comically terrible.
But tomorrow night, we've got Paul Nuttall against Andrew Neil for a whole hour. A whole hour. I mean, the whistle pitch is going to be so loud.
That's going to be a blood sport in itself, isn't it?
Without going very route one, and I'm genuinely not even trying to be funny here, but do you not think that Donald Trump, I mean this sincerely, has shown that it doesn't matter how terrible you are as a politician, you can still get elected if people just like you? You know what I mean? It's like, what he has done, he has lied publicly, he has done verifiable, obvious mistruths, and people just don't care. Political gravity just doesn't apply to him. And do you not think that somebody like Paul Nuttall, no matter how awful he is, if people like the guy, they'll just go...
Useless. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump, the thing is useless, and that is death. The thing about Donald Trump, I really got an insight into him. On eBay, it's possible to buy Trump the fragrance. Smell of success is the ad, right? That is what it says. When I read that, I realised that the thing about Donald Trump that I didn't appreciate enough is how much of a star he was, that people wanted to be Donald Trump. They wanted to live in Donald Trump's house or in his hotel. They wanted to wear his shirt and wear his tie. They wanted to use his fragrance.
Smell like Paul Nuttall?
And
is that what you're saying?
Who would want to smell of Paul Nuttall?
Trump is also, he is the first reality TV leader. And, I mean, Paul Nuttall couldn't even pull off that TV leaders debate. I mean, that's the difference.
I realise, yes, Trump built a cult of personality before he entered politics. But my point that it doesn't matter how bad you are as a politician, if people like you, you can still get elected. I think if Nuttall projected enough personality. Yeah, you're right, he's lost.
But one of the things that's interesting about Trump, that I saw the people place themselves on a spectrum, at left-right spectrum, and then they place the parties and individual candidates. And they place Trump to the left of the Republicans, whereas we think of him as to the right of it. So his appeal to people, which we understand as being, you know, he's sort of right-wing telling it as it is, know that his appeal is that he's a very successful person who's the voice of business. And basically, if anyone ever again says that what we really need in politics is a businessman, right? I think Donald Trump is the answer.
Jane, you were also reporting that Sky News aren't getting the comments from the leaders, or from Theresa May. They're being slightly kept out of the loop for the live interviews because they're having a spat with Adam Bolton over what he said when Theresa May announced that she was having the election. They knew there was going to be a press conference and they didn't know why. Adam Bolton suggested that she was possibly going to be ill, and her chief of staff had taken that badly. So now,
not only taken it badly, but texted him. And there was obviously some unwritten rule that although the text didn't say, "Do not say this on air," Adam Bolton actually read it out, which was, "Bunter, you're talking tosh." Much to the annoyance of Fiona Hill.
Although I think she was quite pleased that if he did read it out, she'd called him Bunter. And he had to read that bit out too.
But Prime Ministers on the whole don't look well, do they? I mean, that is just sort of a given. Tony Blair sort of aged in dog years whilst he was there. There was that moment where you thought his hind legs were going to go towards the end. And then David Cameron playing Frisbee on the beach, I mean, with his top off. It looked like he was on his fourth Frisbee and he'd swallowed the other three or something like that.
I'm not going to make fun of anybody for how bad they look with their top off. That's all.
I work for John Major, and it's an amazing thing to go and visit him now compared to what it was like when he was actually in Downing Street. And in Downing Street, we were always kind of, you know, we didn't have a majority. We were 25 points behind Tony Blair. Nothing we did would go right. Even the chicken was thinking of defecting to the Labour Party. And now you visit John, he's incredibly relaxed. He's very genial. He's not, you know, the cares of the world are off his shoulders. It's an amazing experience.
That's different. Not happened to Tony Blair yet, though, has it?
Well, yeah, well, I think it has a bit, actually.
Do you?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know him, so I didn't know him when he was in office, so...
He wants the cares back, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does, though, yeah.
So, in terms of Theresa May, she said she wasn't going to do the TV debates, and she said she wanted to get out and meet the voters. That's what she wanted to do. And then she got out and conspicuously avoided the voters. So she's not good at debates. She's not good at meeting the voters. She was Home Secretary for 6 years and didn't meet any of the immigration targets that were there. You question, what exactly is she good at?
Well, she seems quite good at going on the One Show, doesn't she, with Philip? And wearing lovely things and, you know, letting him appear like a normal spouse.
As Home Secretary, I think she was really good on the police. I mean, immigration was more difficult. But I had there were a lot of sort of civil liberties issues and issues of police conduct, which were important to me. And I always thought she was good at those. I think she had good record in a lot of different areas of the Home Secretary.
But one of the most things that people say as a compliment about it is that she works long hours. She's hard working. But I mean, I'm guessing that chicken during the election worked long hours. Doesn't mean that they should be running the country. she isn't a people person, is she?
I think working long hours is the least you can expect of what's supposed to be the most powerful person in the country.
Thing about getting out and meeting the voters, because one of the things that politicians who become leaders of parties, they want to run the campaigns they've always run. So John wanted to be on the soapbox, even though that was really impractical and it meant everybody got sort of virtually mobbed every time he tried to do it. You know, and William liked to speak and do big speeches, which weren't always necessarily appropriate for the news and all that. And Theresa likes to knock on doors, and actually that's not actually a very televisual thing. So one of the things you try to do as an advisor is to tell them you can't do what you always do. Now you're leader of the party. You have to, you know, campaign differently. I don't blame her for not doing the debates because the debate format is awful, and I wouldn't want to do it.
But this idea that she isn't a people person. She's not good with people, is she? I mean, she was asked about why do nurses use food banks, and she said, oh, that there are many complex reasons why people use food banks. They're not complex, are they? They're poor and they're hungry. You can't imagine anybody's ever gone to a food bank and gone, you know, somebody said, oh, can I help you? And they've just gone, I'm just browsing, you know. Ed, let's move on. You talked about people with their top off and you weren't going to abuse people for pasty bodies. You've had your top off various times on your Road to Mandalay, now all available on iPlayer. This was your trip with Dara, sort of through Thailand and...
Thailand and Myanmar.
Yeah, and ending up in Mandalay, Road to Mandalay, you were saying actually Mandalay, quite a disappointing place. The journey better than the destination.
Without a doubt. And when we finished filming at 10 o'clock, there was literally nowhere to even get food at that hour of the night. We sat and ate crisps and looked out
and
at a derelict,
I was thinking of
Mandalay.
Do you know the way...
Final rap party.
Yeah, sounds great. But
if anybody covering that for, like, you know, the Telegraph would be like, you know, we quaffed water and guzzled Pringles on the licence payer's expense.
Unless you were Jeremy Clarkson and then you just thump your producer.
Yeah, there was no violence. There was no violence.
But so it was a personal pilgrimage for you in some ways because you got to... you'd done some work campaigning for the Moustache Brothers who were locked up in Burma. Yeah. And they'd been released, and you got a chance to go and see them live. Now, I'd done some campaigning for Amnesty to release Zaganar, and Zaganar obviously got released as well. I noticed the Moustache Brothers actually doing some of Zaganar's material on the Road to Mandalay. So I was wondering how you felt about that, and whether
I was not aware
whether we should be locking the Moustache Brothers up again
for Nick and jokes. Are you absolutely sure that Zaganar originated the material?
I'm pretty certain he did. Yeah.
Well. I think it's the least of their worries. I've got to say, they had literally two lines of political humour in the entire show, and the rest of it was dancing and jumping about and wearing moustaches and pretending to smoke cigars and things like that.
A man who lives his act from satire. Looking at him on the television, he's not only is he a moustache brother on stage, he's a moustache brother the entire time.
But even some of the references to the Stasi just feels a little dated. I don't know, there was just something about it. They were performing the same act that they did back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Has anybody watched The Young Ones recently? It's more of an historical artifact than a piece of entertainment, I find.
But you're travel is something that you enjoy. You're a bit of an outdoorsy type.
You and I went through Siberia together,
World's Most Dangerous
Roads.
We always have that, don't we? They always say, you know, do we have Paris? You and I don't have Paris. We always have Ust-Nira.
Ust-Nira.
Yeah.
That's probably near where my dad was in prison.
Well, really?
We had to travel the Road of Bones. And Edgar and I always get to say, people go, what's the coldest you've ever been in? And we can, people go, minus 30. Ed and I were in a tent in minus 52.
Yeah.
God. And we were told not to piss, weren't we? Not to piss outside. But if we had to go for a piss outside, it was so cold it could freeze the piss back onto your knob. So we were told to shake it around a bit to make sure that didn't happen. Yeah.
So my dad was in a prison village on the edge of Siberia. And so he basically was one winter, but then Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, so he didn't have to spend a second winter, which probably would have been fatal, I would think.
And have you been out there?
No. I mean, I think that my parents always felt with these things that they'd been, so I didn't have to.
Yeah.
You know what's called... You know what's called when the cows wear bras? The cows actually do wear bras in Siberia.
That was
like udder warmers to stop the milk from freezing on the cow. I mean, there's a frappuccino.
What did you wear?
when Ronald Reagan decided that, you know, he was going to Bitburg to the SS cemetery, and then they decided that they, because it was SS cemetery, you ought to visit Belsen as well, basically. And I heard this on the radio, and I went down. I said, "Oh, you never guess what, Mum? Ronald Reagan's visiting Belsen." And Mum, without turning around, my mum said, "So what? I've been."
You obviously, Ed, in terms of you're very keen to do some climbing. You've been trying to climb the Munros in Scotland.
That's correct.
All of the peaks over 3,000 feet. I've never quite understood this, I'm climbing them because they're there sort of thing. You know, I always think, well, why don't you imagine that they're not there? Or I'm going to climb every peak in Britain over 4,500 feet. Oh, there's none of them. I'll be able to stay at home and have a cup of tea.
Congratulations on completing that round.
Thank you very much.
Of 4,500 feet mountains. I don't know why I do it. And it's annoying because I get asked that question a lot. When did you get into hill walking?
And you get a lot of time to contemplate it as you walk up the hills.
And I have yet to come up with a cohesive and reasonable or even catchy answer. I mean, should just make one up. I should make one up that's not even true and just claim that
you could argue that it's a chance to do good deeds, because there was a wonderful thing on the BBC News website, Ed Byrne rescues hill walker. This was a few months ago. It's not quite the story.
A man hurt his knee. A man who had overpacked, ladies and gentlemen. He was carrying too much gear. His leg went into a hole and he twisted his knee and he couldn't really walk very well anymore.
And there were two bits to the story I really enjoyed. The first bit I really enjoyed was you asked him, are you okay? And he said, I'm fine. You went on for a bit and then he decided that he wasn't fine and he caught you up. Now... If a man with a twisted knee catches you up...
Yeah, we stopped for a bit. Actually, no, we went the wrong way. That's right, we tried to get across the river at a place where you couldn't cross the river in winter. You could only cross the river in summer at that crossing, so we had to turn back. So that's how we caught. And then also, we went up the river and then down again. So we were on the other side of the river when he called to us. And myself and my companion, I was out there with an outdoor writer called Phoebe Smith. When we saw him and he waved, we both just went, fuck. he's gonna ask for help, isn't he? And so we gave our help willingly.
You did.
The thing is, we were racing the night. We wanted to get back to a certain point on the walk before dark, and we now weren't going to get there before dark.
And you were very sweet. You gave him your poles.
I gave him the walking poles. I took his big, heavy backpack. I gave him my light-as-a-feather pack, And we walked him out. And then I tweeted about it, and then the BBC Highlands and Islands website wanted to talk to me about it, so I spoke to them. But then it went everywhere. And it was all of them. It was the Mirror and the Sun and all that was Ed Byrne saves Walker. Everyone had a thing on it, except for the Express, which said, EU migrant steals backpack from stricken hiker. wah, wah. And then people are giving out to me. They're like, you didn't really save the guy, you just carried his back. That's all I said I did.
Well, the report I read, it just said Ed Byrne took this guy's backpack and then made him carry his backpack. There was no mention of the relative weights.
No, he was carrying like a bag of coal. And I didn't even realise until we dropped him off. He had like 4 litres of water on him. There's streams coming off the mountain everywhere. There's beautiful, crystal clear water. Scottish, good Scottish clear water. Maybe a little bit of sheep shit. But, and he's carrying bottles of Evian in with him. He's a tool. Should have left him there.
Let's hope he's not listening to this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Before we go to questions, let me just tell you about who we've got coming up June the 26th. We've got Peter Hain, one of your fellow lords, will be here. Peter Hain, ex-minister, anti-apartheid campaigner. He'll be here with Catherine Bennett from The Observer and Lucy Porter. And then in July, we've got Clive Lewis, currently the MP for Norwich South. Also got Miranda Sawyer, and we've got Glenn Wall. And we will, if anybody's interested, we'll be at the Latitude Festival, where we've got Sophie Walker, who's the leader of the Women's Equality Party, and we've got Maya Foa from Reprieve, and in the Night from the Sunday Times. So if you get a chance to come along to some of those, that would be great. Anybody listening on the podcast, please get in contact andyparsons.co.uk if you would like to. So we're hoping that our Slacktivist Action Group will manage to answer a question or two.
Hello, thank you. I don't know whether it's symbolic, but we've just sat and had about, well, maybe half an hour on politics and then 10 minutes on the mountain. But one of the political party leaders hasn't even been mentioned, I don't think. Holt Jezza. I just wondered if anybody had a view on him.
He's quite a difficult person to work out. I remember was sitting in the Commons and my eyes were sort of distracted by a sight behind me. And I said to my friend, I'm really sorry, but I've just seen the leader of Her Majesty's opposition walk by with a large box of oranges. Now, there's an element of him that's kind of like wants to be on his allotment rather than be leader of the party. You know, but on the other hand, he's also, you know, is on his third wife having divorced two for political reasons. In other words, he's also quite, I mean, just seriously, he has. Because he's quite, you know, because he's kind of incredibly focused and political. So working out who the real Jeremy Corbyn is, I think, is quite difficult.
Jane?
Well, one thing I would say is that the manifesto that they came out with, you know, what would be the point of having Jeremy Corbyn sort of come up and be the left wing, sort of come from the left with all these ideas without having, you know, all the things you most want? So yeah, bring back, you know, get rid of tuition fees, all these things that actually people didn't really want in the first place. And you know, this stuff, I do get it about, well, how much is it going to cost? But honest to God, every single commentator, probably even in The Guardian, was like, doesn't, you know, how much is it going to cost? It's just the Labour Party don't really know how much things cost. And lo, the week after, the Tories come out the same thing. There's not a cost in it. So I sort of think, actually, it's true, Danny. It wasn't the most costed manifesto they've ever done. So actually,
and the cost has changed recently.
Whatever you think about Corbyn as a leader, and I know, you know, he doesn't make the most leader-like leader we've ever had. He's not particularly good with the media. In fact, he's not any good with the media, I would argue. But you know what? That manifesto, there was quite a lot that was really interesting. And if you're going to vote for something different, you know, we moaned. And you remember the whole thing about 2015 was, what's the difference? Miliband's on one hand, Cameroon's on the other. They're all a bit the same. They all went to the same school. They all went to the same college. And then you've got someone who's so different with a manifesto that's so, so different. Well, that's great. That's great for politics.
Did you have anything you wanted to add?
I feel that no matter what misgivings I might have about how, you know, his lack of maybe media savvy and things like that, I feel like any time you say anything that criticises him, it feels like you're joining a media pylon. I think the manner in which he'd been treated by the media is grossly unfair. I don't like to join in with that. I do have to say, it doesn't matter what you say about him, you'll offend people. I discovered this just on the show I was on Sunday night. I made an offhand comment, just a glib comment. We were talking about people had tattoos of Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese leader, now the leader of Myanmar. And I just remarked on what British politician would people get a tattoo of? Yes, maybe Churchill. And then I just said, I bet you'll see some Corbyn tattoos before the year is out. And I got attacked by people saying, typical anti-Corbyn bias from the BBC and typical left-wing bias from the BBC. So it really doesn't matter what you say, it seems.
But I suppose in some ways the reason that people feel they can have a go at him because the poll ratings aren't good. He's been described as political Marmite, hasn't he? And you're thinking, well, you know, arguably that's a bit harsh on Marmite. You know, if you imagine that 50% of the British population love Marmite, 50% hate it, Jeremy Corbyn would kill for those sort of popularity figures.
My favourite opinion poll demonstrated that Marmite isn't like Marmite. Most people are indifferent to Marmite.
No.
Yes. An opinion, it was a very good opinion poll. It shows that people aren't split on Marmite one way or the other.
Go. You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here.
Yeah. I'm reminded of a great Mitch Hedberg joke. I was in a band when I was in college. People either loved us or hated us or thought we were okay.
That's pretty much it.
So let's see if we can get one more question and then we'll wrap up finally. Is there anybody else who's now been inspired by that first question? Here we go. Yes, please.
Is there actually anyone worth voting for?
Danny.
Well, I'm like in a really lucky position. I can't vote because I'm in the House of Lords and you're allowed to vote, so I don't have to answer that question. That's my way out of it. No, seriously, look, I think I do agree that there's a real choice. And I think that Jeremy Corbyn does represent a real strand of opinion. It doesn't happen to be mine. Further than that, I think it's quite dangerous and unrealistic. But I would, you know, because that's my politics. And I certainly wouldn't. That's not, my problem with him isn't that he's sort of useless or not worthy. I think he does, one of the things you have to say about him is he managed to win the leadership of the Labour Party from that position. That's quite an impressive feat, actually. Twice, yeah. So in that way, that's not my problem with him. My problem with him is that I don't think that form of socialism is practical and would be a very good idea, and I would say that.
I'm going to say a really sort of, you know, journalistic, unbiased thing, which is I think it's always someone worth voting for. I don't believe in that. I had, weirdly, the last time I went to the hairdressers, had this massive row with the hairdresser who said he was going to spoil his ballot paper again because there's no one to vote for. And I think that's a terrible cop-out. I think you've got to vote in whatever your constituency is, I think, whatever you believe in. You know, there's always going to be a reason. There's always going to be someone.
Well, we always try and get people to actually do something in between the shows. And obviously, we would encourage you between now and the next show to go out and vote. But as we now know, you, not only can you vote, you can also spoil your ballot paper and vote at the same time. So that's what we'll encourage you to do.
I think you all should. I think it's very important to vote. I think people died for the right to be able to do it. I think it's very depressing, depending on where you live. I know that my own constituency, he said like a politician. I know that. I've spoken to my constituents.
In Ireland, are we now, Ed?
My constituency, where I live,
yes.
One of the safest Tory seats in the country, like he was elected with 20,000 votes. The next candidate was the UKIP candidate with 6,000 votes. I may as well take my vote and throw it in the sea. Where I'm living. And that can make you feel very impotent and very frustrated. What I think we should be pushing for is voting reform. I've just come back from New Zealand where they have a system where they have a list system where, as well as when you vote for your local constituent politician, how many votes every party gets also counts towards a small proportion of MPs who just based on the sheer number of votes cast across the country for that party. An argument against making voting more democratic is, well, then marginal parties like UKIP will get in and Green Party will get in. They're like, well, it's fair enough. I don't like UKIP, but they got a lot of votes and they should be more represented versus, say, the SNP, who I do like, compared to how many votes they have.
Some people like the smell of UKIP anyway, don't they? So, you know, that fragrance is coming off the shelves. So good. Thank you very much for coming along tonight, ladies and gentlemen. For those people who are listening on the podcast, please subscribe. It is the slacktivist thing to do. You don't have to download it. You don't have to click twice. If you could spread the word, that'd be great about what's coming up. We'd like to thank our guests, obviously. We have hardly mentioned Donald Trump this month for the first time ever, possibly with good reason. He's over in the Middle East at the moment talking about various things, but not mentioning human rights at all, which is probably not surprising given that he's the man who said recently that torture definitely works, even though his defence secretary, Mad Dog Mattis, said torture definitely doesn't work. And you're thinking, if he was called Mad Dog before he was working for Trump, what sort of dog will he be like after? He'll be rabid, won't he? He'll be like a dog who's eaten a tub of deep heat and then licked his own testicles, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much to our guests tonight. Would you please give it up for Danny Finkelstein, Jane Martinson, and Ed Byrne? Hopefully see you next time. Thank you very much.